Okay, so the last 9 months or so, 10 months, I've been doing some work, which is initiated by a fellow who's no longer with us. This question of Canadian history.
Did he die?
No, he's on to other things, but he did some very important preliminary research into the 19th century in Canada. So we're going to talk about that tonight, because it's very important in terms of understanding where we are right now as a nation, and where we're going, and how to address various cultural problems which Canada has. But first, I would bring up a couple questions. So, what is history? And can there be a science of history? I don't know. Do people have any thoughts about this question? Like, when we think about what history is, what comes to mind?
Past, present, and events that have happened, things that we can use to learn and progress our species.
Now, is history a mere accumulation of facts?
Not to be.
I agree. Because the question, I guess, is what actually generates history? What generates the facts that we get pummeled with in school? Fox TV? Well, they certainly create something.
Universal principles that govern us, if they're well managed, the record causes it primarily. And then people write books or whatever, and they're disseminated through verbally.
Universal principles?
Yeah.
Awesome.
Well, because without universal principles, there would be no such thing as like us even being able to like have a past sort of thing. There would be no us having memories and so on and so forth.
Space.
If you do this, it's kind of pointless because what's the use of history?
Yeah, it's very sterile and dead, huh?
So, really, make history, you need to understand it. And the only thing you have is the past. That explains. So, if you connect the events together, you need to find the causes which cannot be directly perceived by the senses.
That's a good observation.
History is not mere science because it's different all the time, changing. Because the facts are the same, but the people tell is the people that tells them that it's what it's true. Because like before, it used to be accepted that slavery was normal. And that was history. And now we can then. And it all depends on the interpretation.
Well,
what if people don't.
But see, that's from the standpoint that it's just statistics and you can't know truth. And that's the general conception of what science is these days, too. So, but, I mean, I understand what you're saying, and that's one of the problems, right, is that that's the way that we look at society and everything. And that's one of the corruptions which is, in a sense, destroying our culture right now and is leading to this collapse. What we're going to look at tonight is this question. I think what Nicola said about looking for causes, right? Like, he asked the question, I mean, something we'll discuss. Confederation 1867, right? Has anybody ever wondered why Confederation happened? Why it happened in 1867 and not in 1841 or 1890 or 2004?
Because the United States. And if it was Kyoto, we had a tradition there, and the United States were physically omnipotent in terms of being extremely open. So by creating this thing, we could prevent that from entering the space.
Yeah, you got stuff done, kind of stuff like this going on. Uh-huh.
Basically, I think we have to look at is what was the intention behind people in the United States, and what was the intention behind people in Canada that actually caused the conflagration to happen?
Yeah.
What was those people? Because the people that lived at that time, they had an intention and they had a vision of where they wanted this, that nation.
Mm-hmm.
I think when we're looking at history, we always want to focus on that question, like what did those people want? Or like,
Want to add, that's important to look at intentions, but at the same time, like, also, I imagine you agree, we need to look at the cause and effect of things, like what this type of thing produced. And that for me, like, tends to remain rather constant in Canada, and the thing is, like, people's intentions, a lot of people say, you know, well, I meant well, but really, what they did might have not have caused all that much good in a lot of ways.
Yeah, there's a lot of, I mean, the thing that we got to keep in mind is there's a lot of different stuff that plays a factor in how history unfolds, but that, for sure, we can't know anything if we just look at the facts. That's the big problem today, right, is you got to... And it's like this asymptotic thing where, you know, you as you dig deeper and deeper into this stuff, you come across, you develop a more and more profound sense of how the history was unfolding. Do you ever get it all? Probably not, because you're talking about humanity, and humanity is very complex, right? I was having a conversation with Bruce Director last week or the week before, and he made an interesting point. He said, you know, you got to look at, and this is what Schiller was doing with his History of the 30 Years' War, and Shakespeare was doing with his history plays. Because, I mean, humans are essentially ironic. So the thing's history is ironic. And just as in science, okay, the great discoveries are always made when you find a paradox. Right? You find a paradox in what you're seeing, which doesn't really correspond to your assumptions about physical space. Right? It doesn't correspond to your assumptions about the history of your country. Right? And then asking this question, well, why am I seeing this? Or what's going on? Why is it this way and not another way? Right? And asking these kinds of questions about those paradoxes. And hypothesizing, like a scientist, you know, hypothesizes a cause, you know, to what he's seen, a cause which he's never considered before. So this is what we want to think about. And that's what we've been doing with this work in the 19th century. Now, you also have... We see this today. I mean, you look at George Bush, right? I mean, when you want to talk about irony. The irony of George Bush is not that he's an idiot, right? The irony is that the American people willingly elected an idiot. And that there were people who actually wanted to put him into power because he was an idiot. That's the irony. So this is how you want to approach history. Because if you forget about irony, forget it. You got nothing. Because you've forgotten what it is that makes us human, right? And is a primary cause in determining how history unfolds. So we need to keep that in mind. Now, this other aspect of this is axioms. Right? Lynn talks a lot about axioms. In terms of the collapse that we're in right now, you know, we have this problem where people have certain assumptions about the way things work, right? Globalization, free trade, stuff like this. And as long as we stick with these particular axioms, then there's no possibility for solutions. Right? And you can think of geometry is a good example of this. Right? I mean, you look at, say, the difference between a line, a surface, and a volume, or a solid, right? And the quality of action that's possible, you know, say within, right? In, say, one-dimensional space, two-dimensional space, and three-dimensional space. Right? What you can actually accomplish is different based upon the manifold or the kind of geometry that you're operating in. Okay, and history is like this as well, and culture is like this. Right, and what we're in right now is a period where we have to shift the kind of axioms, the kind of assumptions, the way people are thinking about the universe, right, and about humankind. And this is fundamentally what's going on in the 19th century, right, as Canada is developing. Right. So this is some of the stuff that you want to keep in mind when you're in school, whenever you're looking at historical works. Right, this question of irony and axioms. Right, to give you a sense of what is driving, what are the processes which are driving the culture. And also, for example, when a culture accepts a certain axiom, right, that culture is only going to be capable of certain things. And this is key for Canada. Until we break the axiom or this problem we have with thinking like a colony, we're never going to amount to anything. And we'll continue to be looted, and we'll continue to have these inferiority complexes towards the United States and Europe, and we'll continue to see each other, see ourselves in terms of other nations. We'll never have a real identity, and we'll never develop. We'll never really, you know, reach our full potential as a people. Now, one of these good questions to ask is, why did Canada not develop as rapidly as the United States? You know, what was the difference there? And I wanted to... whoops. I forgot it, actually. No time. Okay.
What was the difference in the colony? The amount of people in the colony and
Well, I think the 13 colonies had a greater population, that's for sure. It was always a problem with New France that they couldn't get enough colonists. Right? They couldn't get enough people coming over for various reasons. The land was very inhospitable, for one thing. Further south, it was much easier to build up farming and accumulate wealth. So that was one factor. Really...
Something like the
Yeah, well, we're going to get into this. Yeah, but I think you're right. That's for sure. It's a fellow who observed, an American, who observed in 1840 some of these differences between the two countries, which I'll read here. He said, though the ratio of the increase of the population has been greater in Canada than in the United States, yet their increase of wealth has barely kept pace with the population, and they are as poor as they were half a century ago. They have enjoyed the blessings of free trade with England all the time. We have only enjoyed them a part of the time. Whenever we have attempted to supply ourselves by our own industry with the comforts and necessaries of life, we have improved our condition as a people. And during the intervals of free trade and large importations of foreign goods, we have relapsed again into a condition bordering on bankruptcy. While the Canadians have been constantly exhausted and kept so poor by free trade as to be unable to get sufficient credit to even have the ups and downs of prosperity and bankruptcy in succession. We weren't even lucky enough to have those boom and bust cycles, man. So the other thing, I mean, where's the map here? You got this nice map of Canada up here. One of the biggest problems we faced, which Nicola pointed out to, was the British oligarchy. And that is best typified in Canada that I've come across so far by a fellow named Lord Strathcona. His real name was Donald A. Smith. Oh, yeah. Well, he bought some property in England and got to be in the House of Lords and got himself onto the... All right. Yeah, see, his name has power. Very disruptive. The nameless one, yeah.
I'd take that off.
It's okay. Yeah, Lord Strathcona, Donald A. Smith. And now he started off in the Hudson's Bay Company. Now you see Canada here. Canada at the time was pretty damn small. And actually it was four colonies. You had Nova Scotia, you had New Brunswick. Canada was basically this area here. Lower Canada. And Upper Canada was really just the area from maybe where Hamilton is now along the coast of Lake Ontario up to Montreal. Now, in 1925, a bunch of Scottish settlers came over from Scotland to settle up near Ottawa. By traveling now from Montreal, they were only 3 hours away. But in 1925, took them 28 days to travel what today would take us 3 hours or less. Right. They had to take these forest paths, right? They've been brought over from Scotland to settle the land, right? They've been promised these fertile fields and all this land and stuff like that, and you know, they get here and they have to take a boat up the river, right? Then there's no roads, so they're taking these forest paths, and I mean, the boats is like once a week and this kind of stuff, right? And totally inconvenient. No infrastructure whatsoever. Literally. So this was kind of the state of things. Now, who controlled the rest of Canada? We had some people living in British Columbia, what's now British Columbia. But the majority of that land, anywhere from 2 to 4 million square kilometers, was controlled by the Hudson's Bay Company. Now, this is no cuddly little department store, all right? This was an empire, right? I mean, it was bigger than most of Europe, like in terms of the territory. And it was controlled by the late 1940s, early 50s. Donald Smith was the key guy that was...
18,
sorry. I'll just use the last two digits. Mid-40s or 50s, Smith was basically running the whole show. Now, these guys had a policy of promoting or prompting the Indians to kill anybody who traveled through Hudson's Bay territory that wasn't licensed by the company itself. Right? They would offer money for scalps or for the killing of these guys. You know, explorers, fur traders who didn't have a license to trade in these territories. But the other thing was, they just didn't want anybody else in the Canadian colonies to know anything about the land there. Right? And the general assumption on the part of most Canadians up until even past Confederation was that Greenland was more hospitable than Northwest Canada. These guys knew. I mean, Smith had traveled this whole area. He knew that you had this agricultural region right now around in Saskatchewan, Alberta, and Manitoba that had been cultivated for over 100 years, right? And the reason this is one of the best places to grow wheat on the planet is because in the time when the wheat is ripening, you're getting like 2 extra hours of sunlight a day. That's important, right? They knew about the resources, right? The water resources, the land, the minerals, I mean, all kinds of stuff. They had spent the entire time mapping and figuring out what was actually there. So they were fully aware of the wealth of this land, yet they wanted to hold on to that, right? So they were impeding the progress of the nation massively in order to loot it, right? They didn't care. There's no intention to develop Canada. That's very important to understand. There has never been an intention to develop our nation on the part of this British-centered oligarchy. Now, Smith, he was the head of the Hudson's Bay Company. Around the time of Confederation, when he actually bought the land, he got the company's territory sold to the Canadian government for £300,000. And he caused a massive freakout, right? Because everybody thought the shares of the company were going to collapse, right? Because he just sold something like 3 million, or whatever it is, square kilometers of land for nothing, next to nothing, right? So there's a run on the stocks. But Smith knew that land was going to be real valuable one day. So he had agents of his, and you know, nobody else realized, buying up all the stocks, right? And he managed to become the majority shareholder in the company. Right when it was all said and done. Donald Smith. He became Lord Strathcona, and he was basically the governor of the Hudson's Bay Company in Canada. Right, and he was the one that had the policy of killing anybody who came onto the land that wasn't authorized. Yeah, he basically ran the company in Canada. He ran the operations here for the guys back in London. Yeah, he was Canadian. Well, yeah, de facto chief, I guess, but just of the land, like the territory. I mean, today it's most of Canada, but no, they organized to have the land sold by the Hudson's Bay Company to the Canadian government in the years after Confederation, but nobody knew, not even the Canadian government knew anything about the land, the quality of it or anything. They sold it for £300,000. Pounds. That's what Canada was. Yeah, the rest of it.
3 million square kilometers.
Roughly. I mean, it's big. Millions of square kilometers. The majority of what is now the country. Right? They controlled everything. Everything that wasn't the colonies, right? Upper and Lower Canada and in British Columbia. So big.
Oh,
massive. Okay? But the thing was, part of the deal, right, was that there would be massive land grants in all of the counties, land that could be chosen by the directors of the Hudson's Bay Company, which happened to be now Donald Smith. Right, and this land sold for hundreds of millions of dollars over time. Not only that, within 50 years or so, you had like a 1,300% increase in the value of Hudson's Bay Company stock. Right? Looting. A 1,300% increase from $9 a share to like 130 or something like that. Between, say, 1870 and 1907. The fur trade. They had a monopoly on the fur trade.
So, like, basically, when they found cannabis and stuff,
well, now they're like this department store thing, which is different, right? They got rid of the fur trading thing back in the day, but they were still massive landowners for a long time. The thing was the profits of all the, because they sold the land. I mean, the land that they got in this deal from the Canadian government, they sold back to the Canadian people, like immigrants who would be coming to the country, right, for large amounts of money, right? And this is what was going on. So this was the idea of the oligarchy. This is what Canada was all about, right? This was not about development. This had nothing to do with the ideas of the American Revolution, okay? So now there's this. I have this great book, and anybody who ever wants to can borrow it. You have to treat it nicely. It was written by a guy who actually knew Strathcona personally, and spent quite a bit of time interviewing him, speaking with him, and stuff like that. Was actually present when Strathcona caused the collapse of various governments in the 1870s, 1880s, and so on. But now to go on with this a little bit, I don't want to go too long, but. He also, at a certain point, with the wealth he got from the Hudson's Bay Company, bought up a major share in the Bank of Montreal, okay, the biggest bank in Canada at the time. It's still one of the biggest. Okay. And he also, in the 1880s, was the key guy in gaining the monopoly on building the Transcontinental Railroad, Canadian Pacific Railroad. Okay, which was one of the biggest looting operations probably in human history. It's right up there. I mean, these guys make Enron look like... And that's what we're going to... So I want to read a couple selections from this to give you a sense. Because what this guy really does is at the end he summarizes in a sense what was the effect of Strathcona and his activities upon Canada, right, in this very formative period. Right, of the young country, the first three decades. Because, and when I read this, it answered a lot of the questions I had about the industrial policies that were being developed, which we'll get into later, in terms of why things turned out the way they did. So,
I will...
W.T.R. Preston. I don't know anything more about him than that. So that's him as Preston. He's quite a good writer. The Life and Times of Lord Strathcona. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So... The cost to Canada of the influence that Lord Strathcona was able to exercise with parliaments, governments, and statesmen, whereby the railway across the continent passed from being an asset of the Dominion into the possession of himself and his associates, is incalculable. The cash subsidies paid to the syndicate for the construction of the main line, special subsidies on branch, subsidiary, and other subsidized railways, absorbed by the syndicate, and handed, and the cost of the sections constructed by the government and handed over to the syndicate amounts to more than $75 million. Remember, this is 1907 currency. All right? $75 million. The land grants for the main line This is a big problem. These guys got to choose. They got to take possession of lands on both sides of the railway. They got to put the rail line wherever they wanted. So they take it through the most fertile territories. And then basically get the land in that area for free. Right? So this is what was going on. So the land grants for the main line and to other companies absorbed by the syndicate will realize not less than $400 million. Yeah, it was just a massive scam. Massive booty. Add to these figures the subventions and subsidies to the other transcontinental railways, because they built two other ones as well, that had at last to be constructed to compete with the Canadian Pacific, heavily subsidized in cash and guarantees, including the cost of the part of the Grand Trunk Pacific constructed by the government. And these items aggregate $600 million. The value of the land grants to these competing systems runs into $50 million. These items aggregate in cash and land values the enormous sum of $1,125,000,000, more than the entire cost of the Boer War to the taxpayers of Great Britain. In the case of the Boer War, Great Britain secured a united South Africa. The Dominion, on the other hand, has nothing but the satisfaction of knowing that the railways running through the country belong to others. To this, add the indirect cost to the general public by the imposition of exorbitant freight rates upon the toiling masses of the on the prairie lands of the West, and the figures loom up in a haze where language fails to find expression in arithmetical calculations. But that is not all. The land grabbing that followed the adoption of the principle so energetically worked for by the syndicate opened the door for the wholesale robbery of the public lands only then made possible. Sir J.A.M. Akins of Winnipeg, in a speech in the House of Commons in the early part of May 1914, made the astonishing statement that no less than 43 million acres, all in the fertile belt of the prairies, the finest wheat-growing land in the world, had been given away to railways and other corporations in the last 30 years. This means that a territory nearly twice the size of Ireland, or an area larger than England and Wales, or greater than Belgium, Holland, Denmark, and Greece together, has passed out of the possession of the people of Canada for no return whatever to the public treasury. This may seem inconceivable, but it is absolutely true. The fact becomes more evident than ever that if Donald A. Smith had never succeeded in getting possession of the charter of the Canadian Pacific Railway, this shameful sacrifice of an invaluable heritage could never have been made. Had the Canadian government expended the necessary part of the $600 million represented in the form of cash and guarantees, as represented in the as Alexander Mackenzie, one of our prime ministers, and the patriots who supported him loyally decided should be done, the Dominion today would own today every mile of the three transcontinental lines. This calculation makes no allowance for the value of the land, free grants of which to corporations would not have been made, but the proceeds from which would be a national asset. A statement of these facts is necessary to a history of the times to which reference is being made. It will be well for the present and future generations to calmly realize the consequences following injudicious, ill-advised, or corrupt handling of a national heritage. The people have not finished with the question yet. Lord Strathcona's syndicate will be the ever-present death's head at the feast for many years. The account is far from being settled. More than one government will come and go before the bill is finally paid. So that was the railway. But it doesn't end there. Because the question is, the man who controls the only transcontinental railway, which is the biggest corporation in the country, controls the Hudson's Bay Company, which is one of the biggest corporations in the country, and is a key guy in the biggest bank in the country. You want to talk about trusts? So what he was capable of doing is what we're going to look at next. This legacy to Canada from Lord Strathcona presents serious aspects, the full meaning of which must sooner or later be thoroughly understood by the electorate. For 30 years, the Canadian Pacific Railway has been a dominating force in the parliamentary life of the Dominion. Senators and members of the House have been publicly retained by this great corporation. Cabinet ministers have borrowed large sums from individual members of the syndicate, which they were never asked to repay. The acquiescence of parliaments and governments to ever-recurrent demands of railway lobbyists was therefore obvious. Directors of the company, having seats in parliament, with most engaging candor and frankness, are listened to calmly while they argue in favor of or in opposition to proposed legislation solely from the standpoint as to how the interests of the company will be affected. Compared with representative legislative chambers throughout the world, the situation in Canada has no parallel. It is inconceivable to any student of British parliamentary institutions, either in Great Britain, New Zealand, Australia, or South Africa. Yet Canadian statesmen within the four walls of Parliament and politicians outside flatter themselves with the idea that their legislative procedure is modeled on the lines of Westminster. To an impartial observer, the contrast is appalling. That's where the British Parliament is. Mm-hmm. Okay. And one final part here, which is how he sums up the book. Okay. Ever to have introduced methods into a young country tending to lower the standard of political life is a serious offense. To have persisted on that line for a quarter of a century is criminal. A young country, like a youth entering upon the responsibilities of manhood, has nothing equal in value to a true discrimination between right and wrong. Once weak in that moral sense, and the responsibility is serious, to continue the destroying influence, and no palliation can be offered for such a crime. Parliaments were created to wrench from crowns the control of public interests that were being exercised for personal gain. They were never intended as media for the creation of private wealth. In Canada, Parliament has been used for the most improper purposes, under the most extraordinarily demoralizing influences that ever became operative among a free people. The Donald A. Smith Syndicate is entirely responsible for this state of affairs. To rid itself of the accumulated evils in the body politic, resulting from the continual prostitution of a legislative body, which had been left without a single blemish by the earlier statesmen of the country, is the problem now to be solved in Canada. That's how he ends it. So this is Lord Strathcona. Now, the thing is, that's a portrait of one guy. He's not the only guy. But this is the mentality, right? This is the conception towards Canada that the oligarchs have had. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The idea is that what he puts out to the population who's going to read this is that the parliamentary system in Canada at the time has been fundamentally corrupted by 30 years of this guy and his cabal throwing money into the electoral process, collapsing governments at will, right, bribing not only one party, but both parties. Right, they were bribing everybody. I mean, we're talking about millions of dollars at a time in a very poor country. Millions of dollars being thrown into these elections in order to influence events, right, to just totally drown out any kind of opposition and stuff like this. Hmm? Yeah, you've got everywhere. You got Strathcona's name is on buildings everywhere. Right? So he's got this, so he seems like, oh, this nice guy who donated all this money. I'm not sure. Well, I'm sure. I mean, the thing is, you had this one line, right? The CPR, which was transporting all the grain of the western provinces. Right, so I can imagine that they would have been tied up in other businesses. Right, but they had a basic monopoly, and they could charge whatever they wanted to these farmers. Right, so all of this wealth, these billions of dollars which they looted, it all came from the Canadian people. Right, and we were not a rich people. So keep in mind the fact that we were capable of doing what we did under the most unfavorable of circumstances that you can imagine for a new nation. And I think that says something about what we're capable of doing now. So this is Strathcona. There's a lot more to this guy in terms of what he was doing. A real egomaniac and just all around despicable character, right? But this is what we have to deal with in Canada. It's like we're in some kind of state of limbo. Right, between what the United States was created to be, right, a nation free of this kind of aristocratic control, right, and Europe, which is totally, you know, inundated with this stuff, with these parasites. And here's Canada, somewhere in between. It's like some kind of schizophrenic state where we don't have an aristocracy, but we don't have a problem with an aristocracy. It's like, it's kind of there, but we pretend it's not there. It's like the Queen, right? She's just a figurehead. She doesn't have any real power, all this kind of stuff, right? So, but it's not true. So, that's the oligarchical perspective on Canada. But it's not all bad, right? It's not all bad. Because you had circles that were moving in a much different direction and upon much different principles. And this is typified by a fellow named Isaac Buchanan. And he was actually a merchant. You know, when you talk about this question of paradoxes, here you have a merchant. Now, the majority of the merchants operating in Canada were British. And they were all free traders. Right? It was good for them. Right? They got to... Who cares what you're shipping around, right? These guys were all connected to these trading houses back in Britain. So they were shipping manufactured goods over to Canada. And they were shipping various forms of dry goods back, like wheat, things like that. Right, so the majority of them, they didn't really care. They just wanted to be able to trade and ship things around, whatever. But Buchanan was actually, in Canada, for much of his life, the primary advocate for labor. Right, he was a labor organizer, for one thing. He was a promoter of industry. He was a promoter of protection. A merchant promoting protectionism? That's weird. That means he has to pay taxes a lot. Stuff like this, right? This is a pain in the ass for him. This is going to harm his international trade, which is a lot of what he's doing. So... you got to think about those now. Okay, so what's the character of Buchanan? What's this guy actually like? And that's what I want to outline here with a couple quotes from this guy's biography. All right. So possessed of an active and powerful brain, of benevolent and liberal instincts, wealth that buoys him harmlessly over the malignant buffetings of a sea of factions, the fury of which can only be realized by those experienced in the ways of a colonial democracy. It is not to be wondered at that Mr. Buchanan, while pursuing his own course of ameliorating our social and political evils, should come in for his share of that virulent abuse and misrepresentation that is meted out to all our public men in proportion to their prominence. But with the well-fortified subject of our sketch, it is, indeed, like biting the file. And there is no greater treat to the reporter's gallery in our House of Assembly than to witness the manner in which these petty assaults are received and turned. The imperturbable good temper, the quaint and witty retort, which leaves the muscles of the face unmoved, like the mask of the chorus of a Greek play, are irresistibly droll, and always throws the House into a fit of uncontrollable laughter at the assailant's expense. This was his biographer, who was also his secretary when Buchanan became the most prominent politician in Canada, when he was called the president of the Executive Council, which is basically second in command to the Governor General. Now,
when did he become that?
In 1864, which we're going to get to in a moment. Now, he said, too, and this is something very important, I think, for today in looking at politics, right, is this question of principle and standing for principles. And one thing Buchanan would always say is, you know, let me read you a quote directly from him that he gave at a speech. He said, and this is upon just winning an election, okay, to return to our immediate position this day, I should have stood at the head of a minority with as proud a mind as I now stand at the head of my vast majority. Our success is most valuable at this crisis to the province. This is during a depression in 1857-58. As well as to Hamilton, in securing us the power to do much good and in preventing our opponents from being used as the instrument of infinite harm. But still I shall never, either in private or public matters, consent that my character be dependent on my success, for in that case, no success would mean no character. The character we care for is the mere expression of our principles, and of which no want of success can deprive us. And this is key for understanding Buchanan, how he operated throughout his life, because he really went against the grain in most of his political career. And he actually never joined a political party. He was always an independent. And he would ally himself with one party or another, but he said that whoever he actually voted with or entered into agreements with, it wasn't so much that he agreed with their policies, but it was simply a reflection that they were the less corrupt party, right, that was available for him to work with. So that was the way that he looked at politics. Now, Buchanan and his circles. Okay, we're going to look at this period. Now, Canada's completely undeveloped. Right, there's nothing here. You got this oligarchy that's operating, this merchant and banking elite based out of Montreal. Right, and these guys come over from Scotland, mostly. Scotland is very important in our history. Many of the key politicians, the key industrialists came from Scotland, but also the United States. Many of the guys I found out who actually built up Hamilton, built up our steel industry, our manufacturing base, and later took part in crafting the national policy, which a fellow named John McLean, we'll mention later, called Canada's Declaration of Independence. That was 1878, you know, at a time when the rest of the world is also going with the American system. But Buchanan is at the center of all these networks. So, John McLean, yeah. So the first point I think we should look at is railroads, right? Because what we want to look at is this question of nation building. But they were that these guys, Buchanan and his circle, these guys were nation builders. They came here to a continent that was empty. Right? It was this vast wilderness. Like I said, you know, 28 days from Montreal to Armprior, which is in 45 minutes past Ottawa. 28 days. So they set out to build a nation. Alright? But there was a fight. I mean, because the intention was to keep us backwards. Right? And forces were deployed in order to keep Canada as a raw materials nation of, as they said, hewers of wood and drawers of water. Right? We were going to feed the British manufacturing base over in England. Right? And we would be happy to do so and remain poor and backwards and small. So now, when Buchanan comes here in 1831-32, he starts engaging in politics right away. Now, this question of a nation builder, what is a nation builder, right? Well, this is what Buchanan managed to do in his lifetime, in brief, the various forms of institutions that he set up. He was the founder of churches, educational systems, hospitals, asylums, newsrooms, commercial exchanges, boards of trade, national and immigration societies, insurance offices, banks, trust and loan companies, steam navigation, telegraphing. He had a merchant business. And last, though not least, railroading. Busy man. Right.
Just like these students we meet in the street.
Very busy. Very busy, yeah. The question is, what's the intention? So, you have this interesting situation in the late 1840s, all right? There's nothing here. We had 60 kilometers of railroad in all of British North America in like 1848-1849.
How big?
How much? About 60 kilometers. Yeah. It went from about the... Huh?
What year?
In the 1840s. In the late 1840s. How many in the States? I don't know the number in the States at the time. Probably a lot. I know that by 1900, 1910, we had about 80 to 90,000 kilometers of railroad. At a certain point, we had the longest railroad network in the world, even bigger than the States. So, of course, you got to ask the question, well, how did that get built? It just kind of dropped out of the sky. Just popped up, you know. People decided one day, oh, let's build some railroads. The oligarchy said, yeah, sure, let them have it.
Where did it go?
Where did it go?
Why do you hide 80,000 kilometers?
That's a good question. Yeah, all over the place. I mean, it was everywhere. Three transcontinental lines, that's one thing. Yeah, it was a massive, massive grid. Well, the thing was, Buchanan was intimately involved in getting this whole operation up and running. Now, he had two other guys that are really important. We're not going to dwell on them too much, but if you're interested in looking into this more, you should put their names down. I'll write them here. One guy was named William Hamilton Merritt, and he was one of Buchanan's best friends. Yeah, he's got to go.
Hamilton's old.
Oops, I guess I should use the
voice. Hamilton's best friend.
Hamilton's best friend?
Oh, Buchanan.
Buchanan's best friend. Did I say Hamilton? Oh, man. Sorry. There's all this stuff rattling around in my head and half of it's unconnected.
No, he's just Buchanan. His name is William Hamilton.
Okay.
Hamilton's best friend. Yeah, and best friends with Buchanan.
Yeah. This guy built the Welland Canal, which was acclaimed at the time as being the most important engineering project in all of North America. The Welland Canal, which connected Lake Erie to Lake Ontario, right? It bypassed Niagara Falls. This thing was massive. This massive project. right? And he built that. That was in the 1820s, 1830s. That was the first really big project. Now, this guy, Merritt, his vision, right? He envisioned at that time what we now know as the St. Lawrence Seaway Project, which is a series of canals and dams and different water projects to open up the St. Lawrence for, you know, oceanic shipping and stuff like this. You know when that finished getting built? Under Eisenhower. So this is like when you, because you want to think what these visionaries, right? These people had these grand visions for what the nation could become. And often they never saw it in their own lifetime. Right? But that didn't stop them from actually pursuing those goals. Say, the dreamer, whatever you want, the idealist. It'll never happen, utopian. Right? But they were engaged in this stuff. You know, and then the Welland Canal, right, just like you had the Erie Canal, which connected Lake Erie to around Buffalo, over to the Hudson River, which was another massive canal project around that same time. These canals become the engineering schools, right, where the young engineers get trained in on-the-job applications, but also they're doing schoolwork and stuff like this, and they're learning their trades as the canal is built. Now think about what we're going to be doing, right? In rebuilding our own economies. This is the kind of principle that we're going to employ. You know, you're not going to say, okay, well, we're going to have these projects, but first we're going to have to put people through 5 years of school. No, no, no. They're going to get trained as the projects are built. Right? This concept of bringing in, say, Western expertise and educating populations, in, whether it's in Africa or South America or whatnot, developing an engineering cadre in these countries that can take what they learn on these projects that we do in cooperation and then go and do a whole bunch of this stuff on their own, right? So historically, this is how much of these projects have been built. So Merritt is really key. Very, very close collaborator with Buchanan. You won't find him in the history books, just like you're not going to find Buchanan in the majority of history books. Now another guy, very important, is called Thomas Coltram Kiefer. Kiefer had a nickname. He was called the Prophet of Progress, which is pretty cool. Lynn could, you know, you could think of Lynn as that way, I guess, in a sense these days as well. But Kiefer, he ended up forming or beginning the American Society of Civil Engineers, the Royal Society of Civil Engineers in Canada. This guy was really big. He's the first president of the American Society, even though he's Canadian. But in the late 1840s, you had a little conspiracy between some of these guys like Buchanan, these other industrialists, these guys that wanted to get the railroading going, and Merritt, who was in the government at the time, and Kiefer, who was Merritt's protege, and worked on the Welland Canal. So Kiefer wrote a book, or a little pamphlet, called The Philosophy of Railroads. Right? And what he talks about in this is he's making a case for why we need railroads, right? Why we need to introduce these to the society. And he writes about this little town called Sleepy Hollow. Right? And as the story goes, you've got this little town, not too much is going on, it's kind of cut off from the rest of the world. You know, everybody's a farmer. You got maybe a general store, a couple other little, you know, service-based enterprises to accommodate the farmers. And, you know, the children are born and they become farmers. And they have children and they become farmers. And, you know, or then the children leave, right? Because at a certain point, there's no more land left in the vicinity, you know, for farming. And you don't want to divide the farm up too much. Right, because then you're not going to have enough land to make a living. Right, and this is kind of sad. People don't like that. Their kids are going off to the city and getting corrupted, and, you know, whatever. Well, one day the railroad company comes down. They send some engineers in to take a look, and they're proposing to bring a railroad through the town. And at first, the population's not too happy about this. Right, change. Oh my God, not change. Change is scary, right? You don't know what's going to happen. these big noisy things thundering through, and who knows what it's going to bring, people from the outside, strangers. So they're pretty hostile to that, right? But one of the engineers happens to strike up a bit of a relationship with the mayor's daughter, and a few things happen. And, you know, they get brought into the town, and they win the people over to their side. Charismatic young guys, as the mayor's daughter found them. So, this is actually in the story. I'm not making any of this up. So the thing is, you see the railroad come to town. You see the changes that occur, right? And you see all of a sudden you've got industries opening up. You've got jobs for people that couldn't have jobs before. All of a sudden the children of these farmers can stay in the town, right? There's employment there, right? You have an increased standard of living, right? You have increasing prosperity. Right, there's more other shops to accommodate the industries. Right, now you've got a much cheaper transportation for your agricultural products, right, to take them to the city. Oh, now you can do rotation of crops because you can get your perishables to market real quick. Right. Progress. And the sense that he conveys is that cultural progress and civilization is inextricably linked to technological development. Right? That actually mankind can improve its lot in life, can improve its culture through the sense that the creative powers of the mind. Right? In this case, railroads and the industries associated with it. But fundamentally, it's that he's talking about the moral perfectibility of man. So, there's a section, you know, because I like to read these quotes because it's more personal, you know. And I want to read you a selection from Kiefer, a brief section from the end of one of these pamphlets. By the way, this pamphlet went everywhere. It sold like hotcakes. It was translated into French. It was used in New England even to promote railroading. Right? So it spread all over the place. And these guys caused one of these axiomatic revolutionary shifts through the application of this pamphlet, through the political process of mobilizing people around adopting these kinds of policies of infrastructure development. And there was very little help from England to do that. Most of the financing for these projects, the canals included, initially came from the U.S. Yeah?
I just had two questions. This track, mm-hmm. leaflet, was written by Kiefer?
By Kiefer, yeah. At the request of Merritt.
At the request of Merritt.
Mm-hmm.
And in this leaflet, there was a story of a sleeping hollow?
Yeah, the story was in there.
Cool.
As well as, and I have a copy. People can read it if they just ask me for it, and I can lend it.
Sleepy Hollow?
Yeah. There's an American story by Irving Washington, right? Yeah. It was a guy named, I think, Irving Washington wrote a story about it. That was like the, Headless Horseman?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but it's more, I think, the title. I mean, the story really doesn't, there's no...
She just got lost
totally
with,
different, but...
she was talking about the story of the engineer coming to the city.
What's Sleepy Hollow have to do with
this? Well, you know, you just think of a sleepy little country town. I think that's what... But I'm sure he got the idea from the urban Washington, but... Yeah, Washington. Yeah, Renfrew. Sleepy little town. Little country town. Right, so that's how it was going at the time. So I'll read this because this has to do with what I was saying about this conception of man's role in the universe. It may be a heresy, but is there not reason for a belief that the regeneration of the dark corners of the earth is to be accomplished not through the pulpit alone, nor by sectarian schools, nor yet the philosophy of cheap literature, nor by miracles, but by a practical elevation of the people, to be brought about by a rapid development of commerce and the arts. Ignorance and prejudice will flee before advancing prosperity. Wherever a railway breaks in upon the gloom of a depressed and secluded district, new life and vigor are infused into the native torpor. The long-desired market is obtained. Labor now reaps her own reward. The hitherto useless waterfall now turns the laboring wheel, now drives the merrier spindle. The cold and hungry are now clothed and nourished, and thus are made susceptible converts to a system, the value of which they are not slow to appreciate. The pulpit will then have its grateful listeners, the school its well-filled benches. The stubborn opponents of wordy philosophy will then surrender to a practical one, the truth of which they have experienced. Then let the bigot, the theorist, and the agitator ply their unprofitable trade. Let them lay the flattering unction to their souls that they alone are engaged in the high and holy cause of moral elevation. Let them commiserate the apparently low aims, the ceaseless toil and drudgery of the practical mechanic. But know for a certainty that bigotry and intolerance, agitation, and the highest order of speculative philosophy have existed in the midst of starving and uneducated masses. That it is the steamboat and the railroad which has peopled the recent wilderness of the Northwest, and by granting facility of access and by securing a reward to labor, have diffused a degree of comfort in philosophy unprecedented in history. Every new manufacture, every new machine, every mile of railway built is not only of more practical benefit, but is a more efficient civilizer, a more speedy and certain reformer than years of declamation, agitation, or moral legislation. And shall not the mechanic, ever the pioneer of progress, lift up his eyes from the workbench and look ahead? Has he, the humble instrument in a mighty revolution, no right to think of such things? Quote, "Thou shalt not muzzle the ox that treadeth out the corn." I venture to believe that, as mechanics, we may devote some moments to a consideration of the tendencies, the prospects, and the utility of the great enterprises which give character to the age, and in the execution of which we are in a greater or less degree the agents. That this feeling of being useful in our day and generation will while away with a diminished degree of weariness the many hours of labor. That as you ply the busy hammer or wield the heavier sledge, some of you may dream that you are fast driving nails into the coffin of prejudice, of ignorance, of superstition, and national animosities. That as you turn down the bearings or guide the unerring steel over all the 500 parts of a locomotive engine, fancy will picture you cutting deep and smooth and true into obstacles which have so long separated one district, one family, one people from another. And that you may exult in the reflection that those huge drivers will yet tread out the last smoldering embers of discord, that those swift revolving wheels, by practically annihilating time and space, and by reuniting the scattered members of many a happy family, will smooth the hitherto rugged path, fill up the dividing gulf, break through the intervening ridge, overcome or elude the ups and downs of life's checkered journey, and speed the unwearied traveler upon his now rejoicing way. Thou shalt not muzzle the ox that treadeth out the corn. Yeah, I was thinking about that. I mean, I think you don't want to tie down or repress the very means by which you achieve something.
Oh, so
it's talking about the mechanics, right? If these are the
talking about selling the corn, not
It could be either. It could be crushing it. I mean, I'm not sure exactly the process you're talking about. I think the idea is you don't want to repress or suppress unnecessarily that which brings you prosperity and progress. So that's kefir in a nutshell. So that was a big operation that these guys ran in order to bring about this transformation. Okay, against the free traders, against the people that want to keep us a resource economy. Now the next big thing, the next big shift that these guys managed to pull to bring about was in 1858, which was the first protectionist tariff in our history. Now in 57 you had a massive depression, a big financial collapse due to the usual kind of speculation, things like this. So the country was in pretty bad shape. And when I read that quote earlier of Buchanan after this election, right, where he's talking about, regardless of whether I win or not, I stand on my principles, right? And he makes this thing, it's a good thing that I came into power with this majority so that we have the chance to do great good instead of the opponent, you know, our opponents who would have been the tools to implement great evil. He's talking about how they're going to deal with this depression. So what Buchanan does is he organizes the population, right? He goes out to the manufacturing base, right, to the capitalists or whatever. He gets these guys involved in a committee called the Association for the Promotion of Canadian Industry, the APCI. All right, very important. And he's basically the key guy. And he's known for decades afterwards, from this point on, as the father of Canadian protection. Yeah? The Association for the Promotion of Canadian Industry.
Who's the guy again?
This is Isaac Buchanan.
Oh, he establishes it?
Yeah, he basically forms it, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. I'll put Isaac's name up there, too.
Why not?
And you've got a series of guys from Toronto, from Hamilton, Montreal that get involved in this. What they do is they get together, right, and they figure out what kind of tariffs are we going to need in order to protect and develop the manufacturing base in Canada. Right, so in a sense of like what Lynn is talking about in terms of the same kind of policies, what is the cost of producing something? Right, what are the costs involved? Okay, well, what kind of protection do you need as a nation to ensure that those costs can be covered, right, that you don't get undercut or get to a point right now, right, where companies are forced to either to outsource because they can't produce here and compete, right? So this is what they're looking at. So they get together and do that. They get the government involved. They lobby the government to get a policy implemented of protective tariffs. And this happens in 58. 59, they raise the tariffs even higher, right? But it's a result of this organizing. Now, the other thing is Buchanan's not only organizing the capitalists, as I found out now. I got this other book, which people might be interested in, too. There's only a few pages on Buchanan. But he was, like, the key labor organizer in Canada, right? And then the labor movement, the workers recognized that many times over, right? So he was getting these guys involved as well. And he always said that the real question, the fundamental question of politics, was not even constitutional questions, but the employment of the people. He says at a certain point about an opposing government. He says, they're talking all this stuff, right? I mean, they talk about different constitutional issues. The thing is, what are they going to do? Say they implement these changes, right? The time was, which was to have a representation by population. Right, what we had for about 25 years was 75 seats in Quebec and 75 seats in Ontario. That was how it went, right? Even though the population in Ontario was much larger than Quebec. So you got people saying, well, we want to have more seats for Ontario and less for Quebec and crap like this. He says, okay, that's fine and everything, but what are you going to do for the people? Right, what's your policy? If you make these changes, how are you going to use those changes in order to improve the life, the average life of the working person? And so that's what these people never have. They don't have any policies. They have no principles. So he's very concerned about that, and that's a key factor in why he brings in this tariff. It's not just to benefit his buddies that are in manufacturing. Right? It's to uplift the population based upon American principles. It's very key to understand as well. He was reading Henry C. Carey from 1837 onwards. We know that, okay? And we'll get into that a little bit more later. So they organize this tariff. The first time in history, it's a precedent-setting tariff. And the results of that are profound. As he says in his speech in 1863, one result of our patriotic legislation since 1858 was the existence in Canada of over 1,000 tanneries. The manufacture of paper, of wool, of woodenware, and agricultural implements has equally increased. By manufacturing the articles mentioned, we save the necessity of sending out of the province at least $2 millions in cash per annum. By manufacturing these articles, we not only cause an immensely increased employment for our own population that are not fit for other sorts of labor, but we retain in the province the money for the use of the farming and other interests, thus not only increasing our supply of capital in the province, but reducing the rate of interest at which it can be borrowed. Okay. They're on a gold standard system, so the amount of cash is limited to the amount of gold that's in the banks. Right? So if you're having to send all your gold over to Britain, you constrict the amount of money circulating, which then interest rates go through the roof, and the bankers get to loot the population. Right? But then trade comes to a halt, farms go bankrupt. Right, so it was a bad system. So this policy was really, really effective and got them out of their economic problems at the time and also started developing the manufacturing base, finally. Now you've got railroads that are being built. Right, Buchanan was the key organizer of one of the biggest railroads in Canada at the time as well. Which connected, which went from Windsor to Niagara and went through Hamilton, right? Because the key thing at the time was who's going to control all of the food being produced in Ohio, right? In the U.S. Midwest, which was being settled right now, right? Was it going to go through the states or was it going to come through Canada? The other thing was, and this speaks to Buchanan's connections to the United States. The question is, okay, does this grain, for example, coming up through Canada is the shortest route, right? Does it go to Montreal and leave that way for Britain, which is where a lot of the United States agricultural produce was going at the time? Britain was the biggest market for everything. Or does it go up to Hamilton, then cut and go across to Buffalo and then down to New York via the Hudson? Now, Buchanan had He opened a branch of his mercantile business in New York. This is where he met up with Carey and Horace Greeley and these whole protectionist circles in the States. Right, and that's in 37. So that was the big question at the time, was who's going to control that trade? And that's what what was called the Great Western Railway was intended to exploit, was that trade in combination with these American allies that Buchanan had. Okay. Now the next big thing you have is 1863-64. Now what's going on? You got the Civil War, right? From 61 until 65. Canada's an occupied country. We've got about 15,000 British troops here stationed in the cities and along the border. You've got raids, Confederate raids being run out of Montreal. Right, Lincoln's assassination was orchestrated out of Montreal.
Mm-hmm. What?
Lincoln's assassination, his murder was organized here, yeah. The Fenians, they were based out of the States and they were raiding into Canada, I think. Yeah, these Irish
people that fought with Lincoln.
Yeah, I'm not sure of the whole story there. It's kind of weird, I don't really get it yet. So Canada's you've got certain things that happen, something called the Trent Affair, where the Union captures a British vessel that has two Confederate agents on it, and this almost provokes a war between Britain and the Union at the time. Right, that was in late 61 or early 62. Right, so, you know, Canada, I mean, things are pretty pretty dicey. You know, you have generals in the States that want to invade Canada. They say, like, we're going to crush Canada like a St. Bernard would crush a poodle or something like that, right? That's what these, because they were pissed off, you know, I mean, they wanted to lash out at Britain. But, of course, Canada's in the way. It's like, what are you going to do? You know, and you're in occupied territory, so what Buchanan starts proposing, what he proposed in the early 60s, was called an American Zollverein, based upon the German, what Friedrich List, an associate of Carey, took to Germany. The idea of a customs union, right, that would put protective tariffs against European products, but promote trade amongst Canada and the United States. Obviously, I mean, at the time, this is for the Union, specifically, because the war is still going on, and it's undecided how this is going to go. It's called the American Zollverein. Write that up. The idea of a customs union. So that any trade coming in by any port on the Atlantic or the Pacific, well, I guess the Pacific's not really an issue at this point, but on the Atlantic side, right, based upon the population of the two countries, the relative population, a portion of the revenues, the customs revenues, would go to each country, no matter what port, right, the goods traveled out of, whether it was Montreal, New York, whatever, right? So the idea is you would have a cooperative, like what they're looking at in South America right now, right, but not NAFTA. Okay, don't think NAFTA, because it's not NAFTA. That's not the idea. The idea is, how do you actually, because Canada was losing all kinds of skilled labor to the States because we had no industrial policy. Right, so all these people are leaving to the U.S. Lincoln's industrializing, right, at that time. So they're going down there for higher wages. You know, so it's a big problem for Canada. So you go, well, okay, let's have free trade. Therefore, we can keep these workers here. Ah, not only that, we're still a colony of Britain. Now, these British manufacturers, they all want access to the U.S. markets. But they can't get it because they're British, right? And the U.S. is really pissed off at Britain right now. Now, the other thing is Canada's got lots of rivers. So there's a major potential there to use that water power for grinding purposes, for other forms of manufacturing. So Buchanan says, hey, Britain, you guys should love this policy. You know, because, I mean, isn't Canada just like Britain in America? Right? So you guys can bring all your factories over here. Set them up. We won't stop you. And then you can trade with the States, because we got this agreement with them. Right? And he said, so that's one condition, right? Britain, say, you got this empire thing all wrong. If you want to save your empire, you got to stop being an empire. Because this empire thing's not working. Right? Because Canada's unhappy, we're losing all our people, right? Still pretty backwards. So what you got to do is you got to give us this Zollverein. You got to give us economic sovereignty, in a sense. And we also want an agreement that Canada will be neutral territory between any war, or in any war between Britain and the United States. So, but it's kind of this like sly way of, it's like what Gandhi did, I think, right? He's like, oh, the British, you guys are all about rights and equality and liberty, so give us our rights and equality and liberty. The British, you should want to do that, right? It's in your best interest. We're loyal British subjects. Hey, we don't want to become a republic. We just want to be sovereign. So you got to stop being an empire if you want to save the empire. That's the idea. Because if you keep being an empire, you're going to lose the colonies anyway. So this is what he was proposing. Right now, he put this out in a speech in 1863. In December of 1863. And in 1864, early 64, he becomes elected to the presidency of the Executive Council after having put out a book on this very subject as a platform. The industrial relations, something like the industrial relations between Britain and, can't even remember the name of it. Anyway, this big, thick book that basically goes to this question of the Zollverein, what kind of policies Canada needs, things like this. He also includes an article by the Marquis de Lafayette called, or basically the subject is a constitutional republic around a monarch. Like a monarchical republic, in a sense, right? That Lafayette had written in the 30s. Which is interesting. Right? He quotes Carey all the time. He quotes Henry Clay. Right? His favorite novelist is Cooper? James Fenimore Cooper? So, you know, all these big Americans. His Zollverein project is modeled upon Liszt. So where do you think his influences are coming from, right? The United States. And these circles around Carey. So he puts this out and he becomes the president of the Executive Council, having published the book, you know, several months before he's elected. So obviously he's been elected for this policy. He's given the position of the most powerful politician in the colony, right? In order to implement this policy. He was working with people in the United States who were actually had done a study on it in 59 and 60 and gone to the Treasury and said, we should go with this. This is a good policy. So, he was organizing extensively and intensively to get this thing through. Now, there's an interesting, after this speech, the guy's his great enemy named George Brown, who was the founder of the Globe and Mail and who's a real, real little bastard. He wrote an article in the Globe about the speech.
Who wrote the article?
George Brown. Yeah. Now, Brown was an agent for the British his whole life. And he promoted, and he thought his vision of Canada was a low-cost economy. You know, our competitive advantage is natural resources. We shouldn't get in all this stuff of industrial development and things like that. It's just, that's not what we do. You know, Britain's best at that. We should let them do it. Right? He was Scottish as well. But his favorite economists were Smith and Ricardo, and he was a real big fan of, Russell. Bertrand Russell's grandfather. I can't remember his first name,
John.
But Lord John Russell.
John.
Yeah. So he was his hero. Yeah. Yeah, these Scots are a tough bunch. Some of them are real, some of them are real good, and others are just, you know, they turned. So it's interesting to get a sense of, okay, so this is Brown's, this is kind of this oligarchy's response to Buchanan's speech, right? It says, in other words, England must give up free trade, a principle which, the farther it is carried out, the greater has her prosperity become, a principle which is seated deep down in the hearts of the people, a principle, the correctness and beneficial power of which is recognized by the greatest thinkers from Adam Smith downwards. Or else what? Why, the people of the colonies, smarting under the intolerable wrong done them, will rise against the imperial authority and forswear forever their allegiance to the crown. He, Mr. Buchanan, believed that as a necessary consequence of the free trade legislation of England, Canada would require England to assent to two things. First, an American Zollverein. Second, Canada to be made neutral territory in time of any war between England and the United States. Only this can save us from annexation. What a modest proposition. If not, according to Mr. Buchanan, the inevitable result is that we shall, as did the 13 colonies, become separated from the parent state. Buchanan intends that Canada should be left to herself to protect her territory. With the power of peace or war thus given to us, with all the British commercial interest in us destroyed by artificial restraints, i.e. the Zollverein, what else should we be but an independent country?
Oh my God.
Heavens forbid such a thing should ever happen. So this was the indignation of George Brown, the great father of Confederation. Father of our nation. Yeah. Something like that. Well, Buchanan referred to him as the Canadian Robespierre.
Right.
Because, you know, Robespierre, when he didn't get along with somebody, you know, would have him guillotined. Whereas Brown, you know, when he didn't like somebody, being less manly, would only attempt to destroy their character through his paper, which, you know, the Globe and Mail, which was the most influential paper at the time.
The Globe.
Right? The Globe, yeah. So it became the Globe and Mail. So that was the... Yeah. Should we turn the air conditioning on?
It gets pretty hot right now.
Okay. Yeah. It might be a little bit noisy, but we can turn it on. I was just trying to check. Okay. All right. So, well, now it's kind of interesting because, I mean, Buchanan comes into this position, right, and he's given the mandate to go ahead with this. At the same time, Brown was given a commission to look into certain problems, the fact that government was not really functioning in Canada at the time. Mostly because it was never intended to function, right? And you had these oligarchical elements which were intervening, right, to kind of to break up any kind of collaboration between the French and the English. Brown was one of the guys that was doing that. So he's given a commission to, yeah? Well, he was the head of a parliamentary committee at the time. Can look this stuff up. 63, I think he was put in that position. It's in his biography by a guy named Careless. It's like the key biography. So he was commissioned to look into the various problems and how we could resolve these issues of the parliamentary reform and stuff like that. Well, he filed his report around like 3 months after Buchanan came into power, right, and through a series of manipulation managed to collapse the government. So Buchanan's chance, he was flanked. The other thing that's interesting is that Buchanan's brother, who had been the key guy running Buchanan's the mercantile business, was killed in a hunting accident in England in 1862. He got shot, yeah. And what happened, right, is that the company then went through a series of financial crises in Canada, and then in the late 50s and then into the 60s as well, right? And Buchanan's business went bankrupt in 65. Now, it's just, when you consider what Buchanan was doing, the events with his brother in England, the bankruptcy of the company, what's going on in the United States, what Brown, we know Brown met with Palmerston numerous times and other high-ups within the British establishment. He took several trips in 62 and 64 over to England, spent a weekend with Palmerston in his country retreat. I'm sure they were talking about cricket. Palmerston was Prime Minister of England. Yeah, he was the key guy that organized, or one of the key guys that organized the American Civil War, or the Confederacy. He was key in that, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
He was Prime Minister of England, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. Well, yeah, I think Disraeli was also Prime Minister at some point, but around that time, Palmerston was the Prime Minister in the early 60s. No. No. I'm not sure when it started in Britain, but it was...
It was also one of the heads of the British East India Company.
Yeah, funny how that is. So that was all going on at this time. It's going to take more investigation, but again, you know, you think, well, coincidence? Maybe. Maybe not. Seems suspicious. These events conspired to basically... Because Buchanan, at that point, was forced out of the political arena. Right, and the Zollverein project failed. Of course, Lincoln got killed too, which changes things. So that's to be considered as well. But this is where, for a while, I thought Buchanan was basically finished at this point. He got out of bankruptcy in 78 and he didn't really do too much. That was all I knew a few months ago. But then I found out that there is an archive in Ottawa, the Buchanan Family Fund, at the National Archives of Canada. I think it's called Collections Canada now. So I went there for a couple of days, and Luke joined me for one day, just to, you know, see what could be seen, find out what's there. Turns out there's like 120 volumes, roughly. These volumes, like we're talking about boxes that thick, you know, regular paper. 120. Right? Those are just his notes. That's not his books. I mean, the guy was a prolific writer as well. And all the other articles that he wrote in newspapers and stuff like that. So these are a lot of these are notes that he was taking on currency reform. Get into maybe a little bit later. But the interesting thing was that we found was correspondence between Buchanan and Henry C. Carey, which is the missing link that we needed to establish a rock solid argument for the connection between these networks. So we got it. That was between 64, 66, and 79 when Carey died. Now, you can't know if you have all of the letters that these guys were writing, but there's quite a few. We also know that Buchanan of that period was in a dialogue with President Grant for about a dozen years. He was in contact with President Johnson, who replaced Lincoln. Now, I didn't find anything on Lincoln, but Johnson's there. Now, these guys were talking about policy shaping. They were talking about currency reform, especially between Carey and Buchanan. We got to hold in our hands several original Carey pamphlets from 66 and from 72. These little things. It's pretty cool. So we have this connection now. Now, the other thing is this little book here. Has some big leads in it. It's called A Culture in Conflict, Skilled Workers and Industrial Capitalism in Hamilton, Ontario. There's a whole section in there on Buchanan. The guy actually says, like, listen, Buchanan is like the least recognized person ever in this country. I mean, for some reason, nobody has written about this guy, and yet, when you look into it, he was super important. He's doing all kinds of stuff. And this guy takes it from the standpoint of the labor movement and Buchanan's efforts there. But what you find is that the cadre in Canada that brought about the national policy in 1878-79 were all proteges of Buchanan. The guy who drafted the tariff policy, the national policy, was the secretary of the APCI. And his name was John McLean. John McLean also has the title of father of protection in Canada. John McLean.
Can you get me some water?
So John McLean was the secretary of the APCI. That was another link, which I didn't have, which we only could hypothesize on. So McLean will mention Buchanan in his writings, but we had no direct link. We also have correspondence between the two. I haven't been able to read it yet, but I know the file is there. So I started finding these networks. Right, because I had originally thought, well, Buchanan just played a marginal role after 63, 64, right, because his business was in bankruptcy and stuff like that. But in reality, the guy was literally more active than ever. So you've got the you've got this letter writing going on between these leading figures in the States, right? You've got he's got this protege, John McClane, who ends up, as I said, he worked for the finance minister in 78, 79, right, crafting the national or the tariff policy. From 66 up until, or even afterwards, McClane was a major writer in Canada, an editor for numerous magazines promoting protection. So he was advocating, he was pamphleting, doing all the kind of stuff that Buchanan had been doing for years, right? And literally echoing Buchanan's kinds of policies. So this is a big link. Now, McClane set up an organization called the Ontario Manufacturers Association, the OMA. The OMA basically did in 78 what the APCI had done in 58. Got together all these various interests, crafted a policy, got government involved, got it passed through, or as part of a larger package. In Ottawa, I found an invitation in Buchanan's files to an executive council meeting of the OMA in 78. Say, cool. Another direct link. We also know now, based upon articles that he was publishing, that Buchanan was involved in like all of the elections as a political organizer, right? He helped get people elected to Parliament. See, I think probably, I'd have to look at this again, but if he was in bankruptcy till 78, he probably couldn't hold office. It's possible. I'd have to look at the various regulations in our Constitution. But it's likely that because of his financial situation, he couldn't be in office. But he organized other people to be in office in his place. Do you have a question?
No.
Okay. So, now there's other people as well that later become the organizers of something called the Knights of Labor.
K-N-I-T
of Labor. This is one of the most important labor unions of the 19th century. Now, do you know who started the Knights of Labor down in the States? Henry C. Carey. Yeah. So Buchanan was intimately involved the networks that brought this union into Canada. And the people that became the leading advocates of this union were his protégés, right, who basically picked up his policies, picked up his ideas of currency reform, which, interestingly, was a government-backed fiat currency. And with the power of printing money solely in the hands of government, that was his policy. And he would tie it to the productive powers of the productive powers of labor, right? As opposed to a gold standard. That was part of the Zollverein package, actually. So you have the industrial policy package, you have the trade policy with the United States, and you have the monetary policy in order to take the nation to a whole new level of. Well, that's the funny thing about Canada. You know, it's like Buchanan never comes out as an openly Republican figure. Really. He hides it. He masks it. Some of his associates, this guy, put his name up. You can write it down if you want. His name was Phillips Thompson. I can't remember his first name. But this is one of the guys that organized the Knights of Labor. And Thompson openly advocated an American-style republic for British North America. And that was in the late 1870s, early 1880s. And this guy and a couple others, he's the really key one. He's like the leading advocate of the whole, so what later became the socialist movement in Canada. And he was Buchanan's protege. Yeah? Yeah, he was one of the organizers of the Knights of Labor in Canada. Yeah? Yeah, I'm sure, because Buchanan, I mean, he writes in one of his books, he's like, I want to get Carey's works out by the million in Canada. Yeah? Yeah, in Canada, it got the name of the beaver back. Yeah, it was modeled upon Lincoln's policies. Well, Buchanan, he was into currency reform for a long time. The beaverback policy first came up in along with the Zollverein proposal in the early 60s, and he got picked up. This got picked up and carried on for a long time. The currency reform was the one thing that didn't get adopted with the national policy, probably because of interventions on the part of the financiers. Obviously, they don't, because the gold reserve system was that they could manipulate that, but you don't want to have a currency that's in the power of government. It was massive, yeah. Massive. Pardon? It didn't pass through, no. That was, they backed off on that. But Buchanan was openly, they were writing articles about this like crazy. Phillips Thompson was writing articles like this, about this. Many, many people were, especially within the labor movement, stuff like this. So it was, so this was all going on at the time. And one of the things in this book is they say that Buchanan was seen not only in Canada but also in the United States as a leading expert and one of the leading figures in terms of currency reform and economic policy. So, yeah, by leading circles in both nations, which is pretty cool. So this was all going on at the time. So it changed my whole understanding of what Buchanan was doing. Right? I mean, there's so much more, but, you know, I could talk all night and I don't want to do that. What's important is you got to get a sense of who this guy was and ask what drove him. I mean, he went bankrupt several times. Right, he went bankrupt pretty much because he spent too much of his time in politics. Right, when his brother died, his brother basically run the company so that Buchanan could do his political work. So then he couldn't really do both at the same time, and the business got sacrificed. But that didn't stop him. Right, he died in 81, I think, 81 or 82. And in the early 80s, probably near the end of his life, he wrote an article. I just want to read a quote here. I think this is actually, he wrote this in the late 70s, because he says the proposed national policy, so I imagine it hadn't been put through yet. But it gives you a sense, even at the end of his life in his 70s, what he was thinking about. It says, the proposed national policy, or in other words, the prosperity of our producers in Canada, is the very first and absolutely necessary condition connected with the possibility of Canada building her Pacific Railway by means of paper money. The only way it can ever be done without making Canadians hewers of wood and drawers of water, forever to foreign capitalists who would be her creditors. And such a policy has now happily become possible from the distress and depression of the country, having in a voice, at the late elections, of popular thunder ordered off the old self-seeking parties with all their dead issues and demanded a national policy to remove all obstructions out of the way of the producers of Canada. This, in fact, has now become the whole essential politics of Canada, as it ought to be in every country. It is the only cure for the distress and consequent discontent and eventual socialism, which is the alarming feature of the present day. The people insist that means be taken of securing justice to the Canadian producer. And he meant not only the owner of the factory, but the workers. Right? Because there's a... there's one other thing about this fellow, which I think is a really... That was Buchanan, an article that he wrote probably around 78. Okay, just give me a minute. Oh, right, it's in, I have it in here. Just to sum up on his character here. And this is from his biographer. His biographer says, "Of the many subjects which seem to have occupied Mr. Buchanan's mind, the great cause of labor is that to which he has devoted the greatest amount of thought and effort. He maintains that mere production, or the mere existence of food, is not the first necessary of life under a state of civilization. He says that employment is the first necessary in our state of society, seeing that it in no way relieves the poor man to know that all the granaries of the neighborhood are full of breadstuffs, if he is without the employment, which is the only key to these granaries. He holds the question of our home labor to be unspeakably more important than the question of our external trade, the labor being the necessity, the trade the incident. He has striven that men should really eat and be satisfied with the bread that they may earn by the sweat of their brow or of their brain, and not be perpetually offered up as a holocaust at the shrine of mammon, or become a mere part of the machinery which he oils and drives, and be looked upon by his employers with as little interest as the cranks and wheels of the world's great power loom, in the din of which all uncertain sounds are drowned, together with the moans of the toil-worn. Mr. Buchanan differs from the free traders and political economists, not only as denying that theirs is in truth a system of free exports, while it is certainly a system of free imports, but in this, that their heartfelt interest is in the web, while his is in the weaver, theirs in the produce, his in the producer." So, this question of what a patriotic Canadian is. Buchanan modestly referred to himself as the greatest Canadian patriot. But it's hard to begrudge him that, considering what he accomplished in his life. And against and in terms of the odds, considering Strathcona. The forces arrayed against this faction within the country. But what's important about this is if you want to be a nation, and Buchanan recognized this, you need to have a history. So in the early 60s, the guy wrote his biography. Buchanan employed him as his secretary when he became the president of the Executive Council. But he also commissioned him to write a history of Canada, which is called Sketches of Celebrated Canadians. And there's two copies of it at the McGill Library in the rare book section, which you can look at. Sketches of Celebrated Canadians, which goes all the way back to the earliest explorers. The fellow who wrote it is named Henry James Morgan. And the other person who collaborated on that effort and tried to set up also a royal society for historical research was William Hamilton Merritt. So you see how these guys are working, right? So the thing is, a nation needs a history. And our nation has no history, or a history that's been written for us. So, what we're doing with this is very important. Because Canadians have to know what their real legacy is. Right? Our legacy is not free trade. Right? We were not built on free trade, which is one of the lies that gets thrown to people these days. But this is our legacy, right? It was the fight against these kinds of oligarchical forces. But it was also a fight not to be just like the United States, not to join the United States. Buchanan never wanted to be annexed to the U.S. He was always thinking about how do you create a sovereign nation modeled upon the U.S. institutions, but sovereign, right? This is what they were thinking about. And the example of Buchanan is especially fruitful today when we have to again begin thinking like nation builders. You know, you look at a Canadian history textbook for even first year university, they have pre-Confederation, they have Confederation period, and then you have the national policy, and then you have the nation building period, and then you have whatever, right? So it's like, oh no, that nation building stuff, that's all over with now. Now we're just squatters. Right? That's all past. We did that. Been there, done that, it's all over with. Now we just reap the benefits in purgatory. Well, we got it. Well, what's happened, right? I mean, we've been destroyed. Our rail system is being destroyed, right? Our industries are being destroyed. So we have to start thinking again like Buchanan was thinking, looking at this vast continent, completely undeveloped, much like I've said before, the Northwest, right? And use the example of what he did with his life, despite the adversities, right, to mobilize the population. And he used many of the same principles that we're using, right? What Kiefer did.
They're universal, right?
They are. They're universal principles of political organization. That's right. And think about this and get a sense of who we actually are and the tradition that we represent and that we can carry forward, right, and to mobilize the population around this and the potential we have. Right, as opposed to the kind of shit that we're getting hit with right now. So we need to think. Now, Bruce, when I talked to him that night, he made another interesting point. He said, you know, the present is really the future's history. So we just looked at a guy who changed history. So we got to think, and this is what, you know, he asked the question, why do you study history? You know, it's not an academic thing. You know, you study history so you can actually make history. So we need to be more like Buchanan, and we need to think like this guy. And I think we already are. We're going in that direction. You know, and this kind of work is going to help that in the coming years. And I guess that's all I have to say.